As the years go by and peace in Israel seems like an impossible dream, feelings of frustration can creep in, even for people who live thousands of miles away. Today's guest felt that frustration and set out to do something about it. Frank Romano tells the story of his quest to bring people of different faiths together in Israel and the West Bank in his book Love and Terror in the Middle East, now in a fourth edition. Frank Romano practices law in the United States and France and teaches law, literature, history, and the philosophy of law at University of Paris West, Nanterre-la-Défense. The latest edition of Love and Terror in the Middle East came out last year. The book was originally published in 2010, and Frank went to elementary school in Ashland, so back in the old hometown. Thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
It's great to be home.
Take us back to the beginning, or not the very beginning, I guess, but the beginning of your desire to help peace in the Middle East.
Well, it happened, Jeff. I was studying at the Sorbonne in Paris years ago. About 30 years ago, and I come, from Ashland, also raised partially in Northern California in rural areas, disillusioned with big city, how can you be disillusioned with such a beautiful city, the city of love? Well, I'm not used to subways. I even got the impression I was turning into a rat. I was spending more time underground than above ground, and I was a bit depressed. Hadn't seen family in a long time, not used to living alone. So I had kind of like a dream, a vision of some kind that I should get out of Paris. Here I am a student. I am a waiter in the restaurant there. And I just took off. And the vision told me, go to the Middle East, do some interfaith work. Now, this was in 1978. I get out of Paris. A month later, I'm out. I'm taking a slow boat to China type of train, chugging down to the border across the Mediterranean into Morocco. I didn't have the money for the plane. So, that was the slow route across Africa. Eventually, I'd get there and then into the Middle East, Israel and Palestine. And I entered into a mosque. I was invited in. I was kind of crashing in the streets, didn't have a lot of money. And an imam, who was the head of the mosque, invited me into the mosque to learn about Islam. And that was a perfect arrangement because I needed to do that. And it turns out that I picked the wrong mosque to learn Islam in. It was a fanatic group. This was 1978. These groups were not on my radar. Didn't know what they were all about. And before I knew it, they were holding me prisoner inside the mosque, and the only way out was to escape and return to Paris. And so that was the first time I had influence. I was influenced by the situation and of course, strong extremist religion. And it went on for 25 years. I thought about whether I should, and I returned to the States in the meantime, went to law school, became a lawyer. And it was always in the back of my mind, this vision I had, was it just a fantasy or a true vision? Find myself, and I'm fast forwarding now, 25 years later, 2005, I was at my university. At that time, I got my PhD at the Sorbonne, and I was a tenured professor, met a Jewish professor from Tel Aviv who told me all this stuff about the interfaith things going on. A light went off in my head, said, well, gee, I set out to do that years ago. And within 2 months, I was in. This time I took a plane. Been there, done that with Africa. I took a plane this time. Got into Israel and Palestine. It's been magical ever since. There's been incredible things happening. So the origin, to answer your question, the origin to what I do now started there and has been pursued since 2005 with incredible progress, I see, even though I'm not artificially optimistic. A lot of progress has been made on the grassroots level in Israel and the other side of the wall in the West Bank for peace.
Any personal ties? I mean, you're, from what I gather, you are neither Jewish nor Muslim, or at least weren't at the beginning. No Middle Eastern blood, I gather, but this is something that really took hold of you.
It did. And personal ties with Jews, Muslims, and Christians in the area, what made it even more personal was totally unanticipated. Here I am in a real contested area in the West Bank doing my interfaith work. Muslim Jews and Christians vying for land, vying for a foothold there. And I'm discovering roots of my own family. In Hebron, I saw a street. I was, in the midst of the interfaith things, what I do is bring in Muslim Jews and Christians to talk and do things together and bond, which is one of the main reasons why there's a conflict there. They don't talk to each other. I found this street. I was walking in the Jewish section of Hebron. A street called Beit Romano. My name is Romano. Beit means house, so Romano's house in Hebron. I'm thinking, okay, that's it. I'm going to do a trace. Turns out that we are, have Jewish roots from my father's side. Romano is not an Italian, originally an Italian name, even though it's, it means from Rome in Italian, and I speak Italian. It really is a Sephardic Jewish name. It started out in Turkey, the family did, and then moved before the Inquisition into the into Europe, into Spain, and to Italy, and also into Hebron, where this family lived. And so now I'm finding some roots of the family. I found we have Jewish roots, raised Christian. My mother here, an Ashlander, who was one of the, actually she was the female star in 1940 at the Shakespearean Festival, British, totally British. Their name is Taverner, and the Barry Taverner side of the family. My father's Italian, Romano. And she, of course, went to the Episcopal Church, the Trinity Church here. And we were raised in the Trinity Church, the Episcopal Church tradition.
Okay, so a whole lot of
mixed
stuff
bag.
To know. Yeah, absolutely. So it seems like one of the first and most difficult things on a trip to Israel would be to figure out what to do. So how did you fall into doing the interfaith work you do?
Great question, Jeff. Well, getting back to my first, at least in 2005, a meeting with this Jewish professor out of Tel Aviv, and she said, I told her about my quest and my dream and my vision. She said, well, you've got to come. We're meeting with Bedouins, Jews, and Bedouins are Muslim, Jews with them, and Christians, and we're going back and forth and doing this and that. But she said, I will introduce you to these people. After that, you're on your own. And yes, they will be suspicious of you. What are you doing? What's your true reason why you're here? Are you CIA? Are you working for the Mossad? Whatever. So, yes, it was very much of a challenge to get started. But as time went on, in Israel and the West Bank, I started building these bonds that you alluded to before. I had personal bonds. I had a fiancé there, actually, a Jewish fiancé. We were going to get married. We ended up not getting married. And then I'm connected very close to the Muslim and the Christian community in my activity. So it's become a personal thing, very connected. And I see, again, as I said before, I see a lot of progress to grassroots efforts. But I bet you, and I'm addressing you, Jeff, and listeners, you don't read about this at all in the mainstream news, I bet.
All right. We'll find out more about your own particular experience as we continue to talk about love and terror in the Middle East. Frank Romano, its author, our guest. We'll come back and talk more with Frank and entertain your phone calls and emails when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. On the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about trying to bring people of different faiths together in the Middle East. Never an easy task. Frank Romano has attempted it many times. We'll get a fix on maybe how many times. His book is called Love and Terror in the Middle East. It is now in a fourth edition that came out last year with some additional chapters of some additional harrowing experiences Frank has had along the way. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the situation in Israel and the West Bank, where Frank focuses his work. 800-838-3760 around the region by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So a couple of different things that you do for a living. You are a law professor, and a law professor who helped train you said that you had unusual reasoning abilities and explosive creativity.
I did?
Why the law?
Who said that? Yeah, the law. Well, it goes all the way back to my youth. You know, I had a rough childhood. I was also pretty much for a rebel and fought my father, and he kind of went overboard sometimes, kind of beat me up a bit. So I was, you know, I felt I knew what it felt like being a victim, being helpless sometimes when I'm here, I'm 5 years old and fighting physically, engaged in physical fights with my father. So I had a compassion for any type of victim. And what brought me back, because I didn't study. I was pretty much a jock in high school. And I ended up being a counselor. I was living in an African-American ghetto, Northern California. I was a counselor in a delinquent, in a kind of a halfway house for delinquents, the most dangerous criminals in Sonoma County. And I realized we used to take them to shrinks, psychiatrists. We used to take them here and there. And it seemed like what they really needed was a good lawyer. They had so many complicated legal problems. So that got me back into school. And when I went to UC Davis on scholarship, and then ended up going to Europe, and then I always wanted to be a lawyer at that point, came back and worked with the lawyers in San Francisco till I realized we're not on the same page. I wanted to control the files. I did a lot of pro bono work as well. Some lawyers were loath to do it because there's no money in it. From then, I opened up my law firm in San Francisco before the next stage of my life came when I wanted to internationalize my practice. I went to Golden Gate Law School, and to do that, I thought the best thing to do was to take a graduate fellowship in Paris. At that time, I was married, went to Paris, ended up getting my PhD, and instead of returning after I met a lot of people in this fellowship to eventually be clients in my law firm in San Francisco, I ended up staying in Paris, and they gave me a professor chair. And so here I am. And just another second on it, I didn't want to live the ivory tower, though. As a professor in Paris, it's really an ivory tower. I mean, it's you only show up one day a week. It's almost like you descend from heaven, say a few words, and you ascend again, and that's it. And so I still had that feeling, I want to work for victims. But they said, well, if you want to become a member of the bar, you're going to have to take the bar exam, which I thought after the California bar exam, I swore I wouldn't take another one. Here I am taking the bar exam, end up passing, and I became a labor law expert there. A labor law litigator with my accent and all.
Your American accent.
Yeah, it worked, though. It I used it. It's kind of a negative, obviously. They couldn't recognize the accent, which was good because, you know, French and we still have that French-American thing. But they thought, well, with the name Romano, you must be Italian. But I had good results using a lot of the techniques I used in the courtroom in the United States.
So your awakening to issues of the Middle East appears to have been in Paris on your first trip there. And you had, for example, a couple of Algerian men who taught you a few things about cross-faith friendships.
Yeah, I was working in a health food store, and they'd put on that Algerian Moroccan music and kind of seduced me to go there. And that plus the state of mind I was in, this was an earlier, this is before I went to law school and stuff, I was in, got me there in the first place got me into North Africa, got me into that culture, got me curious enough to walk into the mosque, although, as I alluded to before, it was inhabited by extremist groups. Of course, I didn't know about this. An expert analyzed this, and then I had to escape and return to Paris. But yes, initially it was my friendships that got me interested in pursuing knowledge about something I didn't know anything about, Islam, and the whole culture around it knew nothing about.
Frank Romano is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Love and Terror in the Middle East, now in a fourth edition. So there are Jewish and Arab communities in Paris. I mean, how did they get along back in those days, and how do they get along now?
Well, that's a good question, Jeff, because you hear about it all the time in the news. In those days where I was, way back in 78, 79, when I initially got this, the desire, the passion to finally make that step and try to carry out the vision I had, trying to find out if it was true or not, those days, it was quite harmonious. There had been attacks, lonesome cowboy attacks here and there. Yes, there have been, because there is a big Muslim population as well as Jewish population in Paris, but harmonious. And now, I lived in a Jewish district for 3 years with my former wife and my two kids. And for the most part, and now this is recent, now this is bringing it up to today almost, contemporary Paris, you hear a lot of news, oh, there's attacks against French, there's, attacks where they've destroyed part of this Jewish cemetery, and this, you hear about it, and the news just blows it out of proportion. The Jews and the Arabs are still working together very well. The Jews I live with, worked in the markets with the Arabs. They were North African Jews, Tunisian Jews. But you hear about the attacks more than anything else. There are three Jewish communities in Paris, and there's a rising Muslim community. And you can imagine when I was in the States on the first leg of this author tour, everyone was trying to interview me about the Charlie Hebdo attack there. And I'd lived right next to the headquarters in the Jewish district, so I knew about that. But they wanted to talk. CBS interviewed me that time, and they wanted me to talk about massacre and blood in Paris. And it wasn't all about that. They were really terrorists. They were linked already to Syria. One of them, Fawashi, I think his name, I can't remember his first name, one of the brothers had already been condemned for jihadist activity. this was not just an isolated Paris thing. So today you hear about the huge migration of Jews into Israel, right? And say, well, it must be because of these terrorist attacks. It's becoming more difficult. But are you kidding? Mr. Sarkozy, the former president, has Jewish roots, and he was elected president. And again, Jews and Muslims are getting basically okay, and Jews are doing very well in Paris. The big reason why French Jews, which I've heard is the biggest immigration coming from a Western country into Israel, coming from France, is a lot of it's for economic reasons. Israel's doing very well economically, better than France, and the shekel, which is the currency in Israel and Palestine, is not as strong as the euro. A lot of investment purposes. I think that one of the last reasons, it is a reason for some French Jews, is a potential terrorist attack, depending upon where they live and so forth. But I think that's not the most important reason, which the press tends to underline, emphasize, I think, erroneously.
So you think too much is made of the conflict, and there is a lot more to the story than that.
A lot more. I mean, there was an incident. This was before Charlie Hebdo, you know, during the Gaza crisis. And by the way, I was in the Middle East during the Gaza crisis because I've been accused of having a death wish or crazy or I have a messiah complex. But I'm an activist, and to justify going to the war zones when it's heated up, because that's when we're needed the most. I happened to be there during the Gaza crisis. There's a lot of protests in Paris over what the State of Israel did in Gaza and so forth. And you heard about the attacks on a synagogue. Well, that was the district I lived in. And I called people up, and yes, it got all over the news all over the world. Here we go again. The Muslims and Jews are at it. This was a group that were protesting what happened in Gaza, the bombing by the State of Israel, that broke away, a splinter group broke away from the main protest group. And since it was close by to the Jewish district where I used to live in, I don't live there now, I'm still very connected there, just found a synagogue and wanted to break into it and attack a few people. This didn't manifest to represent most Muslims or the situation in Paris.
Our guest on the Jefferson Exchange is Frank Romano. He went to elementary school in Ashland, still has some family here. He's written a book called Love and Terror in the Middle East. He visits the Middle East often from his current home in Paris. And you can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange about his efforts to hold interfaith activities in the Middle East. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So when you first settled in Paris, and you were talking about Muslims and Jews working alongside one another, working together is one thing, but you know, getting together and breaking bread in the off hours is another. Did you attend any interfaith dinners or interfaith events when you were in Paris that kind of set you on this trail toward trying to do the same thing in Israel?
No, actually, it came from that initial vision. And when that vision I had, like in 1978, it was sort of a vision I got that came to me. I had absolutely no participation in any groups whatsoever before then. After that, however, the book came out, and I'm blessed to tell you that one of my books, not this book, There's another book called Storm Over Morocco, and that is about the initial attempt to get into the Middle East. And then, remember, I got involved with that extremist group and had to escape and return to Paris, never getting to the destination, to the Middle East, where I go now to do the interfaith work. That's all chronicled in a book called Storm Over Morocco. Now, that book has just been translated into French. And so it made things complicated because Love and Terror in the Middle East, 4th edition, which is the book I'm on the author tour now about, came out the same time as this book. And you really have a 9-month window to do the events, and then that's it for the bookstores. So since the book came out, Storm Over Morocco came out, and that came out in the United States 5-6 years ago out of New York, New York publisher, as my New York publisher for this book, a different publisher. Then a lot of people got in touch with me. I've been very active in the States. There's a lot of things going on here, to the extent that one of the author events, many author events actually, the suggestion is made, well, look, this is about the Middle East. Very interesting. But I can't go to the Middle East. I can't go to the Israel-Palestine. Either I can't afford it, or it's a little dicey for me, or whatever. What can I do? I said, well, you know what? You're absolutely right. I've been engaged in the United States, East Coast, West Coast, and I've been in Texas and working with people and community interfaith, because we have many similar issues right here. And so I went to my publisher and said, you know what? I'd like to talk about what we can do here in the United States. There's plenty of things to do. In fact, interfaith starts at home. It's like if we can work together, different ethnic groups and religious groups here, it's like throwing a pebble out in a calm lake. It will spread out. In fact, what happens in our own communities is a microcosm for what happens in the Middle East. So that I asked my publisher, I want to write a book. He said, no, it takes you too long to write. It took me 30 years to write. Look, just add a chapter. And that's one of the last chapters, about a short chapter on, you know, how we can organize right here in our own communities. So I've added that chapter. The other one, though, and this is the very last chapter, is the one that's made this book, made my publisher call this book the fourth edition. And I can, a real dramatic thing happened in the West Bank that I could discuss if this is an appropriate time.
It is.
It's called In the Midst of a Riot. This is the very latest and last chapter and last edition, because I'm working on other things now. I've extended my author tour another 2 months in the States so I can work with Americans. I see something positive happening in the public opinion in the U.S., and I think it has a lot to do with Americans are seeking other news sources besides mainstream news, and I believe they are getting better informed. And so I want to be a part of it. So normally I'm in the Middle East now. I'm continuing the author tour on it, and especially trying to share with people what happened to me just a few months ago in the West Bank. Here I had organized this interfaith group. Now, this is in a refugee camp, one of the most contested places in the entire Middle East, because this refugee camp called Jenin Refugee Camp is where a lot of activity, with a lot of confrontations took place between the Israeli IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, and the Palestinian forces during the Intifada before and afterwards. And here I am in the middle of it because these refugee camps have become fodder for extremists, and I'm trying to work with all sides, especially these areas, to give the children and other people other constructive things to do, because it so happens from this refugee camp most of the suicide bombers came from. So here I am bringing Muslim, Jews, and Christians together here. It was an incredible event. And so I get back, and as usual, I'm just totally exhausted after these events, and kicking back. And then one of my Palestinian friends came to me, and I was trying to get my messages and half asleep. He said there had been the Israeli soldiers had visited the refugee camp that same night and had want to arrest someone accused of terrorist activities and ended up killing him. And there was a huge riot in the street. The next day, I'm in the middle of a riot. I'm trying to get to my shuttle because I usually don't stay long in the West Bank. I keep moving and I get back to Jerusalem, go back and forth for security reasons. You know, they say a moving target, things like that. So I'm trying to get back to my shuttle, get back to Jerusalem to get organized and get back and organize another event, either in Israel or back to the West Bank. And I can't get to my shuttle. There are hundreds of adolescents and young men in the streets yelling hate mantras, burning tires and breaking things. And I'm looking at this, I'm frozen, never seen a riot before. And all of a sudden, 50 or so of these adolescents, young men, broke away and started running toward me and pointing at me. I'm in the sidelines here, and I'm going, what? And I'm looking, trying to get, I took a step back. I stepped right into a closed door of a store. There's nowhere I could go. Soon they surrounded me. I said a prayer. I figured, now, anything the Israelis do, U.S. is imputed to have done. They kind of know who I am, but, you know, a frothing at the mouth, raging, rioting crowd, they commit atrocities. You hear about it. They don't even know what they do. They don't even understand what they did the next day, but I figured that's it. They're going to take it out on me. Instead of doing me harm, the leader reached out and started to shake my hand. They all lined up to shake my hand, and as quickly as they joined and shook my hand, they were returning to the ranting and raving rioters, and I was just frozen. I was just shocked, and I got back into Jerusalem later on that day, got back to New York, talked to my publisher. I asked my publisher, I could write a book about the last 3 days. He said, no, please. By the time this book is done, I'll be dead. Add a new chapter. And that is why we call it a fourth edition. It's called In the Midst of a Riot. And that is the last edition and the last chapter in the book, Love and Terror in the Middle East.
So you had gotten a reputation, it sounds like, as somebody who was a conciliator, somebody who was trusted by people of different faiths, which is a difficult thing to do, I'm sure, in that part of the world. But how have some of the people who've taken part in your interfaith activities been treated by their own communities when they return to them?
That's a really good question. And that shows, Jeff, that you have some pretty good knowledge on some things. Well, it's been very dicey for them. Now, the Sufis are considered by some Muslims as Muslims, but they originally were Muslim, just like the Baha'is were. But they have a different interpretation of Islam and a different religion, but it's close to Islam, but not the exact same thing. Do a lot of mediation. A lot of, just like the Kabbalist Jews are very spiritual Jews, very believe in, to a certain degree, a harmony of religion, at least very, very mystical spirituality. And the Sufis working back and forth, and other Muslims working with us, they get attacked sometimes by the extremist Muslims because the extremist Muslims believe they shouldn't be dealing with us at all, that we're like working for Shaitani, which is the Arab word for the devil, if you're trying to work peace and harmony. Because this is a good question that we can go right into. My greatest challenges are two things. The extremist groups hate peace activists because they recruit thousands during conflict. What does this give the extremist groups? People, money, and power. It's a money-power game. The other group that targets us, because that's the terror part of the book. A couple of my friends have been murdered lately, which I can go into, and that's also chronicled in the book, my relation to them, are the investors. Now, what are you talking about? The West Bank has turned in, well, as some people know, after the Six-Day War, many settlements were created, Jewish-Israeli settlements. Most of them are Orthodox Jews, on confiscated Palestinian lands more and more.
Okay, there's a whole big story right there. So we'll pick this moment to take a pause and come back to talk more to Frank Romano about his book, Love and Terror in the Middle East. You can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange. Back with Frank Romano and you in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange, final segment, in fact, on today's Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about a part of the world where old resentments die hard, the Middle East, specifically Israel and the West Bank. That is where Frank Romano, who grew up in Ashland, or at least part of his life in Ashland, has spent a lot of his time. He's written a book about his experiences there, trying to bring people of different faiths together for various activities. His book is called Love and Terror in the Middle East, and you can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So we were starting to talk about the West Bank itself, which is regarded as occupied territory by much of the world. Captured in the 1967 war between Israel and Egypt and other Arab countries. And Israel has continued to build settlements in there. And this is a place where you're trying to do some of your interfaith activities. First of all, did you hook up with organizations that already exist that are trying to do this sort of thing? Or did you kind of start your own effort there?
Yeah, at first I hooked up because they were already in place. Either in Israel or the West Bank, but I very quickly realized some of them are really doing a great job and are very authentically wanting to bring people together for peace. But I thought there were ulterior motives to some of these groups, economic motives, politics, and ego. And I realized, you know, the best way to go is to be independent. So when I go in there now, I publicize massively what I'm going to do. So people come from all over the world, Europe and the U.S., Palestine, Israel, to the events. And some of the NGOs work with me. And sometimes we work together if we're on a parallel path, but I stay independent. And I've been offered money and this and that, and realize there's too many strings attached. So I maintain my independence, Jeff, and it seems to work out much better that way. And I can continue working. The downside is a lot of it's out of pocket. So I like putting in the red at the end of the month. But the deal is to continue working my passion. I still have the university salary that keeps me going. I've had to stop litigating. So I've cut off a lot of revenue. But, hey, I'm living my passion, and I see progress, two steps forward, a step back. The downside is when we broke off, was the fact that and that's why I said terror in the title. It's not just to be glittery and attract people to the book. It's the terror part is a real thing. A couple of my friends have been murdered. We don't know who killed them, one in Israel, one in the West Bank. But I was enunciating to you some of the challenges we've had from the extremists, not just Muslim extremists, from all sides are extremists that don't like peace activists because, again, the extremists recruit during conflict, and recruiting gives them money and power. Then there's the investors in the West Bank. Investors in the West Bank, what has happened in these settlements? There's over 220 settlements that have been declared illegal by the International Court of Justice, and they're growing. In spite of the U.S. trying to pressure, I think it's sort of a very weak pressure, unfortunately, by our government, to Israel to stop building these settlements and to stop kicking out Palestinians from their lands and to stop kicking Palestinians out of their lands in East Jerusalem, which is earmarked for a future as the future capital of the potential Palestinian state. Who is going into the settlements? Mainly Orthodox Jews and many investors. So they've turned some of them, there are a lot of luxurious apartments in these settlements, and they've turned them into industrial centers. They're building lots of products. I know Motorola and HP are in there and other American businesses. And these businesses are loath for peace because if a real peace is going to mean they're going to have to start withdrawing from the confiscated land. So they are profiting. Also, this is another theory, and I believe it's been confirmed. A lot of the Orthodox Jews didn't work before the businesses went in. And now they're pretty cheap labor. So it's like instead of outsourcing to China, this has become an incredible place for businesses to build and even manufacture arms on Palestinian lands. And the Palestinians often are without their lands and the trees, the lands they cultivated, they can't feed their kids, and they're not going away. So that's ratcheting, revving the conflict up. But again, the businesses are loath to bring peace because it's profit margin. And we said again, the extremist groups are also profiting from the conflict, and it's money and power as well. So this is huge. And these are our greatest challenges by helping to bring peace together, helping bring Muslim Jews and Christians together in Israel and in the West Bank.
To do what? I've been fairly generic in talking about these as interfaith activities, but what sorts of activities?
Exactly. First, we try to bond Muslim Jews and Christians. And I'll just give you an idea. I don't know how much time we have because I don't want to go over time. But we sit around in a circle, 9-10 people, Muslim Jews, Christians, and we just talk. Eat some hummus, drink some mint tea. Maybe we'll bring in a belly dancer, whatever, and talk. And so all of a sudden, I'll be looking over there in the corner there, and there's an Orthodox Jew with a long beard and a yarmulke and a Muslim with a jalaba and a long beard and a skull cap. And they're talking. They're jawing away. And I'll ask them, what's going on? Well, we're enjoying talking. I said, well, don't you do this? No. We've lived next to each other for hundreds of years, and we don't talk to each other. And we have something in common. What's that? Well, we have children that go to the same school and yet a third village. So they're not talking, well, I'm Jewish, you're Muslim, well, I don't know about your holidays or what. They're talking about the price of lunch went up, the English teacher is weird, everyday things. And the Christian will pop in and say, yes, and I've invited them all for Christmas. And we've been invited to break the fast in Ramadan by Muhammad tonight. But they don't believe Jesus is their savior. It gets into a big religious thing now. And now they're implying that, unfortunately, they're going through the pearly gates. The other guy isn't. They don't share the same God. I said, well, we'll pick up the text, pick up the Torah, New Testament, Old Testament, Quran, which I can read Arabic now, and let's take a look. And at the end of a half hour or so, they realize they're very similar. So I said, I'm going to ask you a question. Do you think you might share the same God now? Now they're hesitating. And then I'll ask them a final question. Do you think that what's the point of killing in the name of God if you share the same God? Think about it. I'll be back. This is to have a dialogue, but this is just the beginning. Many of the peacenik Jews and others, they think this is the end. We share a meal. That's it. No. Then we do the projects. Now to get to the meat of your question. What do we do to real bond? It's not the talking. The talking is just networking. We go in. For instance, we talked about the myriad, or we haven't, or we will talk about the myriad of walls that have been created in the West Bank. It's unfortunately like an apartheid state now. Carved up like Swiss cheese, the checkpoints. A lot of those walls were put in at the expense of thousands of olive trees. So many Palestinians can't feed their kids and other crops because of the walls, the checkpoints. The Israeli Jews own, and with the government, control over 45% of the land in the West Bank. And a lot of the Palestinians, one of the reasons why they're in refugee camps is because of this. So we go in and replant the trees together, talking about to get beyond the non-generic. What do we do together that really bonds? Few words, past the nails. past, you know, give me a paintbrush. Let's have lunch. Muslim, Jews and Christians, Hindus, Buddhists, agnostics, atheists working together. And when we're sweating and doing the projects, that's when the real bonding takes place. And we'll also rebuild it. We went into Bethlehem where a school was destroyed and we'll rebuild it together. These are the projects, and it's during these projects where the real bonding takes place. And at the end of the day, I'll ask them. It's another thing we do. I'll ask each person. This could be a European, a Muslim, Jew, from a Christian from Israel, Palestine, someone from the United States. Go back to your government and pressure your governments. Now it gets a little political, but we can't ignore some of the politics. And pressure the government to get back and negotiate, because we heard about the recent negotiations that fell flat between the Israelis and the Palestinians, brokered by the U.S. Get back and negotiate. It can work if we really work together and work hard.
Grab your headphones. We have a call for you.
Yeah,
here
great.
Is Augie and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Frank Romano, the author of Love and Terror in the Middle East.
Hi, thank you.
Hi, Augie. Thank you for your call.
There was a wonderful jazz musician named Arnie Lawrence who moved to Jerusalem back, I think, in the late 90s and established a school for Palestinian and Israeli kids to learn jazz together.
Fantastic.
I'm hoping it's still there. He passed away just around when you started working on that project in 05. But I'm hoping it's – I was calling partly to ask you if it's still there.
Do you know the name, if you knew a name or who they work with, anything like that?
Arnie Lawrence
was the name of the musician.
Oh, okay. I'm not sure. There are projects. In fact, where the refugee camp I was, a very similar project, not jazz, but they do play jazz during theater. They formed a theater group. More Palestinians and Jews and other people, that mainly Palestinians, to sublimate their hate and to do something constructive. But, you know, there are a lot of groups like this, Aji, and there's Boren Boren, a member of the famous orchestra. You know, chef d'orchestre, I'm thinking of French, but someone who guides the orchestra. What do we call that?
Conductor.
Conductor, thank you. I'm losing my English. He's and famous, goes all over the world, and they play symphony music, mainly Palestinians and Israelis doing it together. So this idea that you're invoking, I would very much doubt if it's not continuing. They continue them. They're helping a lot in bringing Jews, Palestinians together to give them something constructive to do than putting on suicide bomb belts or getting involved in hate or getting involved in some of the extremist groups.
Augie, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. You had said that you're trying to convince people to put pressure on their governments over there. You also mentioned that you didn't feel like it was much pressure coming from the American government to stop the settlement building in the West Bank. That might be a difficult case to make, because one of the announcements of new settlements being built came while Joe Biden, the vice president, was visiting Israel.
And, yes.
It did not go over very well with the American authorities.
No.
So what should the people who are not either willing or able to go to the extent that you do and go to the Middle East and try to get in the middle of things do to provide the kind of pressure or the kind of assistance that you think might make a difference here?
Well, I think it's a fundamental question, and thank you, Jeff. What we need to do is starts from the grassroots level up. We need, I know this is a blanket statement, we need real leaders in this country, not just for these issues, to step up. Most of our, in fact, I won't call our politicians leaders. Real leaders take chances to do the right thing. Like FDR did, remember a long time ago, I'm not necessarily an FDR fan, but he was pressured even by his own constituents to nationalize the banks. And he refused. This was an American thing. And he convinced 90% of Americans, including his constituents, that there wasn't the right thing to do. The U.S. government would assist the banks but not take them over, and he was reelected. We need politicians that become real leaders like that, and if we do have real leaders, they will realize you're going to have to take chances. One of them is to do the right thing is, yes, you can criticize the state of Israel, as our government does. You shouldn't be building settlements, confiscated Palestinian lands, but adding conditions to our $3 billion we give to the state of Israel. Here I have Jewish roots. I'm not against the state of Israel, which is one thing most leaders are loath to do because they feel that they're going to jeopardize their careers. They're not willing to take the steps, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. So all the way down the line, most of the politicians I'm familiar with I don't know them, but I'm familiar with their records, are in the pocket of some corporation or another to the extent that what do they know what's right or what's wrong? They are guided and controlled and manipulated by interest groups. We need real leaders now, and there's a leadership void in the United States and in Europe and in Palestine and in Israel today to step up, and we need to start in the grassroots level to get these leaders elected. I know it's very idealistic because they got to be in control of the political machine, which takes money and so forth, but I think we've got to do it. In our own country, we have a real problem. We get the right people in. You're going to have to take the chances, but we're going to have to start in our communities to rabble-rouse a bit in the grassroots level, getting our government to do the right thing. Because what's happening in Israel, in the West Bank, we are accomplished to it because of the money we funnel there and the arms we funnel there. We're part of it, where many Americans feel that's the state of Israel. We got to support them for good or for bad. It starts here at home.
What, though, do you do, if anything, in France, though? Because there is an ongoing situation in France with the assimilation of Middle Eastern refugees, not just refugees, but people who've moved there permanently. And there's sort of a second-class citizen status for in a lot of European countries for Muslim immigrants. And so are you doing something in France to try to convince people to change there?
Well, now I'm going to address directly the Charlie Hebdo attacks. In France, it's becoming even more sensitive because there's a growing, in particular, Muslim population. The Jews are alive and well there in three different districts in Paris, but the over 20% and growing of French people are Muslim. And I think what's happening then is, yes, you have very sensitive issues when Gaza starts and these conflicts start. And yes, I am working with the people there. I don't have a lot of time to work, neither in France nor in the U.S. in the communities, because most of the time I'm called to go to the Middle East. But there are a lot of groups taking place there. I'm supporting them and trying to work with the people on a grassroots level. So it's an international struggle that we can work together on it.
It's a lot of work documented in your book, Love and
Trying
Terror
to.
In the Middle East. Frank Romano, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange today. Frank, thanks for coming by.
My pleasure. Thank you, Jeff.